April Fool's Day. Jim's comment about my making lots of money and retiring early was apparently his second April Fool's Day joke. And some handouts should be coming around. Imagine that it is 1916 and that you are shopping for records. Upon entering a store, you are invited to take what is called the Edison Realism Test. You are led to a quiet spot where you find a phonograph, a chair, and a scrapbook, and are handed a sheet of paper with a set of six instructions. First, you are to choose the type of music you would like to hear. Next, you are asked to sit facing away from the phonograph while looking at a scrapbook of concert reviews and photographs of musicians. Then you are directed to remember the last time you witnessed a performance of the music you have chosen to hear. Picture the scene, you are told, until it is clearly in mind. Once this mental image is firmly in place, you are to say, "I am ready," at which point the demonstrator plays your chosen record. The final instruction is wonderfully complicated. This is number 6 on the list of instructions in the Edison Realism Test. About 45 seconds after the music begins, close your eyes and keep them closed for a minute or more. Then open your eyes for 15 seconds, but do not gaze at your surroundings. After this, close your eyes again and keep them closed until the end of the selection. If you follow these directions exactly, you will supposedly enjoy, quote, "the same emotional reaction experienced when you last heard the same kind of voice or instrument." What is fascinating about the Edison Realism Test is the importance given to the visual dimension of the musical experience. Listeners are required to go to great lengths, not only to conjure up the correct mental imagery, but also to avoid all possible conflicting stimuli. The assumption behind the test is clear, that in order for recorded music to be comprehensible, listeners must visualize a performance. Seeing was indeed believing. I've chosen the Edison Realism Test to introduce a fundamental but little appreciated fact about recorded music, that listeners and performers cannot see one another. Before the advent of the phonograph, listeners had always been in the presence of, and for the most part had always seen, the performers whose music they were hearing. Yet when musicians record and audiences listen to records, that visual experience is absent. To be sure, I'm not the first to notice this phenomenon. However, discussion of what is sometimes called schizophrenia, or the acousmatic, has tended to be broadly philosophical, or to focus on film or electronic music designed to be heard but not seen. By contrast, my purpose here is to consider music, particularly classical music, that was intended to be heard and seen, and to identify specific and observable changes in the behavior of listeners and performers arising from its invisibility. In a 1993 issue of the journal Psychology of Music, Jane Davidson reported some fascinating findings on the role of visual cues in the perception of music. In an experiment, Davidson presented subjects with videotaped musical performances. She did so in 3 different ways: with the video on but the sound off, with the sound on and the video off, and with both sound and video on. Subjects were then asked to describe the performer's level of expressivity. Remarkably, Davidson found that subjects were most accurate when they watched the performances without actually hearing the music. From these results, Davidson concluded that, quote, "vision can be far more informative than sound in the perceiver's understanding of the performer's expressive intentions." One implication of this study is inescapable, that listeners may lose a good deal of information about the expressive manner of performances that they hear on recordings. In the early years of the phonograph, listeners often felt the need to compensate for this loss of information, for hearing without seeing could be an unsettling experience. As an English music critic explained in 1923, some listeners, quote, "cannot bear to hear a remarkably lifelike human voice issuing from a box. They desire the physical presence. For want of it, the gramophone distresses them." Various strategies were employed in the attempt to restore the missing visual dimension. Two devices introduced in the United States in 1905, the stereophone and the illustrated song machine, consisted of similar mechanisms that, when attached to cylinder-playing phonographs, rotated images in time with the music. As an article in a trade journal crowed, quote, "The illustrated song machine is just what the public has wanted since the first phonograph was placed on the market, and the listener drew a mind's picture as the words and music were repeated to him." By the end of 1905, the device had reportedly been installed in over 2,000 public places. In 1929, a British phonograph enthusiast reported how he had constructed a miniature stage to look at while listening to his favorite operas. He meticulously fashioned scaled-down sets and wooden cutouts of characters in various costumes, all of which he changed with every new scene. Yeah, imagine. And of course, when these rather extravagant remedies were unavailable, listeners simply stared at their phonographs. The practice was, as an American music educator noted in 1923, quote, "an unthinking inheritance from the days when we had no phonographs and when we naturally had to look at the performer." Phonograph companies especially wanted to avoid distressing unseeing listeners, for such cognitive dissonance could hardly be good for sales. To that end, they often used advertising to reassure listeners that the visual aspect of musical performance was not lost in the process of recording. One example may be found in a 1915 brochure from the Aeolian Company. As you can see from your handout, a seated couple is shown facing a phonograph, in front of which sits a harpist. By the way the harpist is drawn, we know that she is present only in the listener's imagination. But by implying that a couple is visualizing the harpist, the illustration assures consumers that the experience of recorded music is really no different from that of live performance. Other phonograph companies sent similar messages in their promotional material. According to a 1923 advertisement, "the piano is really a piano on the new orthophonic Victrola. You can almost see the swift, sure fingers running over the keys." While miniature sets or ghostly harpists may seem rather quaint to us, attempts to endow recorded music with a visual dimension continue today. Consider the videos now encoded on pop CDs, or the immense popularity of music video and the proliferation of television channels devoted to the medium. Certainly, we have yet to suppress the urge to compensate for the invisibility of recorded music. Yet if listeners have long attempted to make up for the lack of the visual dimension, they have at times also exploited it. A 1912 article in the Musical Courier praised the recorded medium for stripping away all that it considered unnecessary to the musical experience, leaving only the essential core, sound itself, according to them. Quote, "In listening to the talking machine, the hearer must of necessity concentrate upon the tonal performance and does not have his attention diverted to extraneous matters such as scenery, costumes, and acting." Many years later, Theodor Adorno likewise argued that opera is best heard on recordings, that is, without seeing costumes and sets. Shorn of phony hoopla, Adorno insisted, the LP allows for the optimal presentation of music, enabling it to recapture some of the force and intensity that had been worn threadbare in the opera houses. More recently, a student told me that for him, listening to sacred music on recordings is powerful precisely because he cannot see the musicians. Hearing such bodiless music brings him, in his words, closer to God. Of course, this effect is not new to the age of recording. It is the same long achieved in many houses of worship by placing the organist or choir out of the sight of the congregants. And in a similar manner, Richard Wagner designed his opera house in Bayreuth so that the orchestra would be unseen by listeners. Thus, audiences would be spared the sight of mere mortals emptying their spit valves in a world of giants, flying horses, Valkyries, and magic fire. Listeners could then experience an integrated artistic whole, what Wagner called the truest effigy of life itself. In pre-phonographic times, such unseen music was the exception, used for specific purposes. Today, however, given the ubiquity of recorded music, such sightless hearing is more the norm. And however listeners have responded, whether by compensating for it or exploiting it, the invisibility of performance is a fundamental part of the modern musical experience. The absence of the visual dimension has equally affected 20th century and now 21st century performers. Musicians have long understood the communicative powers of their gestures and expressions. Think of the percussionist spreading arms wide after striking cymbals, the violinist continuing to draw the bow on a pianissimo note, even when the hair no longer touches the strings, or the electric guitarist with arms wheeling after every chord, a la Pete Townsend. In concert, all of these actions can be critical to conveying a certain effect, and all, when recorded, are unseen and unappreciated by listeners. For a more specific example, consider the conclusion of Franz Liszt's Piano Sonata in B minor. One particular pianissimo chord at the very end is marked with a crescendo. This is, in fact, an impossible request, for there's no way to increase the volume of a note or chord on a piano once it is struck. According to pianist Alfred Brendel, the crescendo can only be suggested bodily. To quote him, "The sound of sustained notes on the piano can be modified with the help of certain movements which make the pianist's conception actually visible to the listener." So you could imagine striking a chord and then maybe lifting your arm up slightly, gradually, just trying to give the sense that the music is continuing and blooming. But of course, you wouldn't hear any difference if you were just listening to it on a recording. Now, we may imagine that Liszt himself achieved his intended effect magnificently. As Robert Schumann once wrote, "The instrument glows and flashes under the master's hands. He must be heard and seen, for if Liszt played behind a screen, a great deal of poetry would be lost." Like listeners, performers have sought to compensate for this missing visual dimension. As conductor Nicholas Harnoncourt has explained, quote, "When recording, you have to add something which makes the process of music somehow visible in the imagination of the listener." How then have recording artists attempt to restore this lost poetry? As evidence of compensatory responses, I would like to point to two trends in the performance of art music over the last century. First, the increased use of vibrato, specifically among violinists, and here I'm going to refer just tangentially to the paper I gave in Syracuse, and second, the narrowing of tempo fluctuation. Before the 20th century, vibrato was treated largely as an embellishment, considered artistic only in its subtle and sparing use. In the first decades of the century, however, the practice changed. Professional, classically trained violinists began using vibrato more conspicuously and nearly continuously, adopting it as an integral element of violin sound. Though there is no single factor wholly responsible for this trend in vibrato, I would argue that one component of it is connected with the loss of the visual element in recordings. I propose that a prominent vibrato helped violinists individuate themselves to unseeing listeners and allowed them to communicate what their unseen gestures and expressions would not. In the first decades of the 20th century, just as violinists were beginning to record in great numbers, the vibrato came to be seen as the most important agent of musical expression. Vibrato is described as reflecting the violinist's innermost soul, as an inner psychic vibration, or as the barometer of our emotions and inspirations. Such comments reflect a striking change in attitude, for before the 20th century, such words would have been used to describe the bow arm or the portamento, not vibrato. Violinists also began to claim that vibrato could help individualize their tone. Siegfried Eberhardt wrote in 1911 that the individual characteristics of different artists are recognizable only when the vibrato is employed. In 1924, the famous violin teacher Carl Flesch remarked that vibrato could even identify an unseen violinist. He wrote, "If two violinists play the same sequence of tones on the same instrument behind a curtain, each using his own vibrato, the individual player may be easily and surely distinguished. While without the participation of the left hand, the identity of the player can only be determined by chance." I believe that the new focus on the vibrato as both a means for conveying emotion and for distinguishing among violinists is connected to recording's missing visual dimension. when seeing always accompanied hearing and musical performance, there was no question as to the identity of the performer. And the expressiveness of a performance was strongly a function of the visual impact of the artist's physical presence. It was purely hypothetical for Schumann to consider Liszt playing out of sight. But when Carl Flesch spoke of listening to two unseen violinists, he was not being fanciful, for every recording artist plays and is heard as if behind a curtain. Although there was no way to replace the visual dimension of live performance, violinists could stamp their own sound and even restore, along with the increased use of vibrato, I would point to another performance trend connected to the predominance of unseen music making. Over the course of the past century, there has been a noticeable move in classical performance towards steadier tempos, with fewer and less marked tempo fluctuations. It would seem unlikely that this trend could be linked to the inability of listeners to see recorded performers. Yet, far-fetched as it might appear, a number of recording artists have asserted this very connection. Conductor Lauren Mazel, for example, has explained that, quote, when you realize that the visual effects which play a role in projecting your expression cannot be used when recording, then obviously your timing is affected, and you tend to tighten spaces between notes. And notice you'll keep hearing this term tightening as a response to unseen performances. Cellist Janos Starker has made a similar point, noting that while in a concert hall, the performer is able to create tension with rests, he cannot do this with recording. The presentation of a composition, he argues, must therefore become much tighter on recording. Eugene Drucker of the Emerson String Quartet has offered a specific example of this tightening response. He recounted how, in recording the Schubert Quintet with Mstislav Rostropovich, the famous cellist encouraged the group to shorten pauses which, in concert, they might normally extend for dramatic effect. As Drucker explained, after the big chord in the coda of the first movement, we took no extra time for a rhetorical effect. Rostropovich pointed out that in a recording, one cannot always afford to play quite as broadly as in performance. The impact of the performer's presence, even visually, can flesh out the musical ideas. This streamlining of approach, Drucker concluded, is required by recording. So imagine, in concert, the performers would have lifted their bows off the string after the chord, paused for a moment, and slowly returned them to the strings for the following phrase. Imagine them hitting the chord, lifting up the strings to connect the first chord to the second chord, and then slowly move to the next one. On recording, however, such a pause would simply have been dead air, something to have been avoided. Because recordings provide no visual continuity during extended pauses or tempo changes, performers may respond by de-emphasizing temporal discontinuities in the studio. This may be accomplished, as several musicians have attested, by tightening the spaces between phrases and formal sections. And it is this tightening that has, in part, contributed to a general change in the rhetoric of tempo in modern classical performance. In discussing the increase in vibrato and tightening of tempo, I focused on performers' compensatory responses to recording. The absence and invisibility of the audience, however, may sometimes be welcome, providing respite from the visual distractions of concert performance. Yehudi Menuhin, for one, valued recording for allowing what he called a monastic dedication, which is oblivious of audience. In some cases, the audience's sightlessness may even benefit the performer. Consider the violinist Yasha Heifetz, again, known for his rigid posture, skyward stare, and blank expression. If you've seen videos of him playing, you can imagine he's writing up a grocery list while he's playing. It's slightly disconcerting. A 1925 article in Gramophone remarked on his deportment. Cold, calm, dispassionate, he stands on the platform and performs miracles of dexterity, displays his beauties of tone. But do we not feel slightly chilled, anxious perhaps for less mastery and more humanity? But the author also noted that Heifetz sounded rather different on disc. These impressions are to some extent corrected by Heifetz's records, he continued. There is certainly a hint of passion and of tenderness. In other words, with the visual channel off, Heifetz no longer seemed emotionless. In this paper, I've considered a fundamental characteristic of sound recording, the separation and mutual invisibility of artist and audience. Whether consciously or intuitively, listeners and performers have long responded to this aspect of the technology. They have ingeniously compensated for the missing sensory input, whether by creating ersatz imagery or by alternating performance practices. Yet they have also found ways to exploit this absence when it could enhance the musical experience. Whether compensatory or exploitative, this adaptive process has been operating for more than a century, as users have continually reshaped not only their relationship with sound recording, but the technology itself. In doing so, they have demonstrated two broad points with which I will leave you. First, that the responses to the invisibility of recorded sound have ironically led to observable changes in musical behavior. And second, that sight is by no means peripheral to the understanding and expression of music. Thank you. Yes?
Did you investigate the phenomenon of background music? What came to mind was, you know, the silent movie deal where the musicians are blindfolded during the seduction scene. Of course, you would not be interested in seeing the musicians in that case. But today you go in the elevator, there's music, etc.
Right. That's a good question. And I actually haven't investigated that in particular, but I think that's an important question to look at, the introduction of background music and Muzak. And I'm sure that has also contributed to our sense that music is something to be heard but not seen. Right. Right. That's an excellent point. That's another compensating activity when it comes to listening to recordings. We can't see the performers, so we have a substitute. We look at the record art, and those images are very important. I think that's just another good example that feeds into this phenomenon. Yes, in the back. Oh yeah, and they're picture records. So you don't even have to stare at a black disc. You could stare at one with a picture and get a little dizzy as you're doing it, I guess. Yes.
Well, of course, you can extrapolate this out to everything, you know, as far as radio is concerned. Mm-hmm. The family gathered around the radio for hours each evening, staring at the radio. But I remember one time when I was now an adult, I had refound just the record. Long since had lost, and as I sat there listening to it, I just felt I'm supposed to be holding something. Mm-hmm. And then I eventually found the full package of it. It wasn't one of the ones with the readers that they would tell you to turn the page on it. It was one that just happened to also have included a coloring book and a puppet show thing on the back. Some of you would know the RCA series that had done that. So there was something that when I didn't have that booklet. There was something missing about playing that record, and you know, after all those years had passed, I couldn't tell you what was missing about.
That's a great example. Another connection. You really felt the need for that visual experience.
There also was another thing. I think it's Al Lewis. It was a pianist around 1950, recorded for London Records, but he was an American, and he would play the piano like this. And that, he wasn't a very good piano player, but that was
apparently.
That was his in-person gimmick in the early days of television.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just another
Al Morgan.
Al Morgan. Oh, okay. No, I've heard of him. Did you have a question?
Oh, I'm
yes.
Yes, I probably have a bunch of questions here to everybody in the room.
Okay, well, how about five? No, okay, one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Do you trace the vibrato with the in other instruments and besides the violin?
Well, I've done research into it. I'm not. I don't make the same claim just because I would have to do the same amount of research. But in looking into this, I found that that singing was coming along with this in the early part of the century. Cello, to a certain extent. Not so much with some of the wind instruments. Part of that has to do with the fact that they weren't recording solo as much. But yes, this is not an isolated phenomenon. But I was picking one, the violin, as an example.
And if I can ask one of those other main questions, you sort of singled out the lack of the visual component as the reason that these changes are taking place. And I'm thinking, especially when you're talking about the use of rubato, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yes, I'll just say no. Thank you, because that's exactly what I say in my book. And that's perfect, because I meant to say, or I did say, but I could have stressed it more, that this is just one example. The intonation factor is another. The technical deficiencies of early recording equipment could be another, and I make that larger argument. So I thank you for bringing that up too.
And just to finish the thing about rubato, editing something that has a lot of rubato, especially when you get into tape editing, nobody wants to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Kraft who's wanting things to be very, very regular, and Stravinsky who wants to play with the tempi a lot.
Right.
Kraft wins.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah, Steve. I did that to a limited extent. I did find, I was able to compare the Schubert studio recording of the Emerson String Quartet with their live recording, and did find that their live recording, the space was longer, not dramatically longer, but it was longer. But I also suspect that it was even longer at the concert, and that the engineer probably cut it down a little bit. The problem is that a lot of these things get edited. Well, I just suspect that if there was, well, it wasn't broadcast, it was recorded live. So I would have to, what I'd have to do is go to an archive where I could be sure that a broadcast wasn't edited, and then do that comparison. But I've done that to a limited extent, and I'd like to do more. Yeah, in the back.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's the question is, has this affected pedagogy? And certainly, because the new aesthetic ideal is a continuous vibrato, and I teach in a conservatory, and all the students are taught vibrate on, on. Now, of course, they do more than that. So certainly it has, yeah. So recording, so these effects penetrate every aspect of musical life. Yes, and a greater emphasis on perfection. Okay, well, thank you very much. I appreciate your questions, and we'd be happy to take more later.
And Mark will be around for a while, so if you want to catch him later today or tomorrow, by all means, he's got some great ideas. Like I said, go out and buy the book. There's great stuff in there.